Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Years after the civil rights era, deep in economic trouble with a black president in the White House, race is pushing back up as an issue. Blacks have taken the worst unemployment hit, but whites are complaining. New York Times columnist Ross Douthat writes this week that poor, rural, working-class whites may have reason. This hour on Point, we'll talk with Douthat, plus Barbara Ehrenreich, Nell Irvin Painter, and more on whites, race, and advantage in the age of diversity. You can join the conversation. Why is race back in hot conversation? Do you see poor working class whites disadvantaged behind white elites and minorities? Is that really our issue? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Ross Douthat. He's a columnist for the New York Times and author of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. His column this week is called The Roots of White Anxiety. Ross Douthat, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So where do you see those roots going, Ross?
Well, the column takes up the subject of college admissions at elite schools, and it looks at data on basically the way that the sort of work of admissions, the process that's set up that attempts to balance the claims of meritocracy, you know, ideas of sort of academic excellence with ideas of diversity, and particularly ethnic and racial diversity, may tend to disadvantage particularly downscale whites. And it draws on data. There's been a lot of stuff, an awful lot of attention paid by various academics to the way admissions work at elite schools over the last 10 or 15 years. But my column looks in particular at recent work by two Princeton sociologists, one of whom I think you're having on the program later, that looks particularly at how, if you look at, and this is particularly in their look at elite private colleges, if you look at how class and race intersect, there seems to be a combination of race-based and class-based affirmative action for minority students. So if you take two students with roughly similar academic qualifications and go down the income scale, the poorer minority students are more likely to be admitted than the middle class and wealthier minority students. But when you look at white students, the reverse is true. So upper middle class whites with roughly similar academic credentials to downscale whites, the upper middle class whites are more likely to be admitted. And so what seems to be happening is that the quest for racial and ethnic diversity seems to be, at least to some extent, trumping the quest for socioeconomic diversity. And I think that this has consequences, in a sense, for how the elite is formed, how the elite relates to the white working class, and how the white working class relates to the elite. And part of what I argue in the column is that what you see happening in the age of Obama and also in the age of Bush are kind of mutually reinforcing paranoias, where because the white working class feels alienated from this multicultural American elite, they worry about, you know, they worry about sort of the extreme conspiracy theories in which Barack Obama is a foreign-born Marxist groomed by elite radicals in Chicago and so on. And they also worry about more general conspiracies like, you know, that Wall Street and Washington are out to get them and want to admit tons of illegal aliens and cheap labor and so on. But at the same time, you have a kind of elite paranoia where, and I think you saw a lot of this in the Bush years, where there was a sense of, you know, what are those white working class Americans out in the heartland doing? And in the Bush years, there was a lot of fear about theocracy and evangelical Christians. And now in the age of the Tea Parties, there's a lot of fear about Timothy McVeigh type militias and so on. And I think that in a way that the composition of elite schools is in a sense a small part of this polarization, but I think it's a sort of instructive way of looking at what's causing it.
So the picture you're painting is of elite schools with what, upper class or elite whites attending and minorities attending, but poor rural working class whites not so heavily represented there.
The case you're making, we'll pull the curtains back much wider because there's so much going on right now. It's kind of unbelievable all of a sudden how big this is in the news. But you write, the most underrepresented groups on elite campuses aren't racial minorities. They're working class whites and white Christians in particular from conservative states and regions. And you go on to put forward this case that it's, you know, it's kids who are in the high school ROTC or 4-H clubs or FFA, right. Future Farmers of America, that actually works against their chances of getting in to what is kind of the slipstream to the ultimately, you know, the elites in finance and law and academia and media and the arts, like those country kids just out on their ear.
Right. I mean, and it's important to recognize that. As a background, that elite colleges are always, most of the kids who apply to elite colleges are already upper middle class. So you're always going to have, I mean, it's the nature of an elite that, working class, the working class and the poor will tend to be underrepresented. But what's striking, and the example you cite is one of the more striking data points in this research, that almost every extracurricular organization that you can join gives you a boost in trying to get into college. The only exceptions that these researchers found were these characteristically sort of stereotypical rural red state activities. And one of the things they suggested is maybe colleges look at those as signs that, you know, if you're in the 4-H club, you're maybe not that serious about going to college because you're going to go off and run the family farm. I don't know.
But I know. As a former 4-H'er, I protest.
Well, good. I think it should be protested. But
you know, I mean, you start off this column with Pat Buchanan giving a speech at Harvard some years ago where he's complaining, saying this is all kind of elites discriminating against white Christians. Right. I mean, all kinds of letters coming back into the Times over the last couple of days saying, look, we are trying like crazy to bring these people in. We don't just define minorities in terms of race or ethnicity. American Prospect blogger, you saw this, Tim Fernholz, comes back and says, you get the sense that you, doubt that, agree with Buchanan's white grievance. And they say, hey, look, Pat Buchanan's homophobic and racist and anti-Semitic, and you're kind of jumping into the cockpit with him.
Yeah, I think the point of the column was that even if Pat Buchanan is, you know, homophobic and racist and anti-Semitic, his point about white grievances about elite schools has some merit to it. So if that counts as jumping in the cockpit with Pat Buchanan, then I suppose I am. But the point here, to be clear, the point is not that elite schools are consciously discriminating against white Christians. The point is that the way the system seems to have been set up mm-hmm. has consequences, and these consequences are first and foremost socioeconomic, but then there are ripple effects. So you have less ideological diversity at elite schools because you have less socioeconomic diversity, and you have less religious diversity. So, you know, 35% of the country calls themselves born-again Christians. At elite schools, it's hard to get data on religion at elite schools, but the Times did a piece on evangelicals in the Ivy League a few years ago, and I think the percentage was 7 to 10% call themselves born-again on Ivy League campuses. And those, you know, again, these things are often semi-inevitable consequences of the way America sorts itself, but to the extent that admissions policies are furthering this kind of polarization instead of reducing it, I think it's a problem.
Let's go right to the data. Thomas Espenshad joins us. He's a professor of sociology at Princeton. He's co-author of the big study, book length, that you cite in your column, Ross Douthat. Thomas Espenshad, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So how about the characterization here? I mean, people have really dug deep on your research, and you hear the conclusions they're coming away with. Do they sound like the conclusions you found?
Well, that's a good question. Let me say, first of all, that I think that the roots of white anxiety, and the anxiety is not necessarily limited to whites or to working class whites, have much more to do with economic fortunes and demographic change than they have to do with what's happening in elite college admission practices. So, as Bill Clinton famously said, it's the economy, stupid.
Did you find that working class whites, poor rural whites, are disadvantaged in the admissions process at top universities?
What we did find is that, as Ross Douthat accurately portrayed, I think, that for non-white students in the applicant pool, and this would include blacks, Hispanics, and Asian American students, the farther down you go on the social class ladder, the greater is your likelihood of being admitted, mm-hmm. all other things being equal, and that's important to mention. The reason why that finding is important is that a number of other authors have claimed over the past several years that elite colleges and universities are not giving lower-income students a boost in the admission process.
You say they are for those groups, but not for poor whites?
But not for poor whites.
Why? Is it a cultural bias?
I don't think it's a cultural bias. The data that we found are subject to multiple interpretations. One possible interpretation, and the one that I find plausible, is that for elite colleges and universities that have limited financial aid budgets and that prize both racial diversity as well as socioeconomic diversity, it makes more sense to place limited financial aid dollars on underrepresented minority students as opposed to lower-income white students.
But what about the goal of having the whole nation ultimately represented in elite institutions?
I think to a large extent, colleges and universities are trying very hard to have the whole nation represented in elite colleges and universities. Part of the difficulty is getting a full representation of all segments of society in the applicant pool to begin with. What you find in the applicant pools for elite colleges and universities is that those students represent a much more privileged slice of American society than you find even in applicant pools at all colleges.
Future farmers of America giving up on the top schools, Thomas?
I don't think they're giving up on the top schools, but it is less likely for students of all racial backgrounds from lower social class categories to find their way into the applicant pools of these top schools, partly because...
Thomas Espenshade, we're out of time right there. I really appreciate your being with us from Princeton today. Ross Douthat, stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about whites, race, and advantage. In the age of diversity, poor whites in particular, Ross Douthat's column in the New York Times this week is getting a lot of attention, as is the story of the USDA official who's out and all the talk about new Black Panthers. The airwaves are alive with race right now. But Ross is looking at one thing in particular, that is poor whites, working class, often rural, and the pathway to elite institutions in this country. His column was headlined, "The Roots of White Anxiety." Just to give the tenor, in case you don't catch it, of what's out there right now, here's Glenn Beck on his show July 9th. Now, this was about the U.S. Justice Department and the Oakland, California investigation about the white police officer killing a Black victim. But after the officer was convicted of manslaughter by a jury, they came in to here was Glenn Beck. You'll hear the theme.
Does anyone have the feeling that this is revenge? That we have a Justice Department that is exacting revenge? We have turned this into the 1950s overnight, except the races are reversed.
1950s with the races reversed. Well, I don't know. Ross Douthat joins us today from Washington. Right now with us as well from Alexandria, Virginia, is Barbara Ehrenreich, journalist, essayist on issues of class and poverty in America, author of Nickeled and Dimed on Not Getting By in America, and This Land Is Their Land, reports from a divided nation. Barbara Ehrenreich, welcome back to On Point.
Glad to be with you.
And with us today from Jalisco, Mexico, is Joe Bajant, journalist, author, blogger, made a name for himself getting deep into issues of America's white underclass. He's author of Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War. Joe Bajant, thank you very much for being with us.
So it's good to be here. I always enjoy being on one with Barbara, too. Hello, Barbara.
Hi.
Barbara Ehrenreich, first to you. I hope you've read Ross Douthat's piece. You've certainly heard the sort of surging, resurgent racial conversation in this country. What do you think of the claim that the white working class, you've spent a lot of time with white, Black, brown, all of it, is being particularly disadvantaged these days?
Well, there's one way I do agree with Russ, and that is I do think there are cultural prejudices against white working class or poor people, and that these are there's stereotypes about people who, are ride around with pickup trucks and rifles in the back and eat white bread and drink Bud and wear polyester, et cetera, et cetera. you know, that is an unfortunate class stereotype. I don't know how it affects the college admissions process. But the context, I think, that has been kind of left out so far mm-hmm. in this discussion mm-hmm. is first of all, access to higher education, not just at elite schools, is diminishing for everybody who isn't rich. I mean, this is just, you know, a wipeout, what's going on. The increases in tuition in the last 20 years have been something like, you know, 20 times greater than the increase in median family incomes. You know, it's a closed door for a lot of people.
Does that matter, Barbara? After all, there's a lot of universities in this country. You don't have to go to an elite school to get a good education.
I'm not even talking about elite schools. You know, the biggest relative tuition gains have been in the public schools because their public funding has diminished. But the other just quick point I mm-hmm. want to make, which is I think is an extremely important part of the context and seems to be left out of this whole discussion about race in Obama's America, is what a terrible hit the black and Latino middle classes have taken in this recession. You mentioned at the beginning of the show, unemployment is three times higher for those groups than for whites. It's also much more consequential because a black family would less likely to have any savings or any assets to tide them over at the beginning of unemployment. And the other feature of it, of course, is that people of color, families of color, were targeted by predatory mortgage companies and are far more likely, whatever their class, to be experiencing foreclosures and home loss. So we're just seeing a tragic setback for the black middle class, and it's kind of strange that we would suddenly be talking so much about the victimization of the white working class, which is important, too.
And when Glenn Beck says we've just taken the 1950s and reversed the races, what are you thinking, Barbara?
I tend to filter him out, I have to admit. No, it's no, it's nothing like that. What's happening underneath all this sort of whining about why it's not getting enough attention coming from people like Glenn Beck, who, by the way, do not represent anything working class. You know, as the Times itself reported, the Tea Partiers are more affluent than average American group. This is a sort of a revolt of people who have some money and some assets and don't want to see it going to taxes or to somebody else.
Joe Bajan, jump in here if you would. What do you see going on? What do you make of Ross Douthat's the warning flare, the perspective that he puts up here about the white working class? And is it, do you think it's being singled out in some way, or is this just economic trouble all over right now? And as Barbara says, again, worse for blacks.
Well, when I read the column, I almost cheered that somebody is bringing it up. I bought it up as an entire chapter in a book 3 years ago and couldn't get an ear for that particular aspect. Everybody goes, why would white people be whining? You know, of course, white skin's not the advantage people think it is. But to me, the bottom line is class, not race. And, you know, for instance, poor whites outnumber all other poverty groups combined. Of course, they tend to be a little more invisible and so on. But by that measure, you know, I think the issue is class and educating across the board, educating America instead of pitting each minority group against all the others for a diminishing slice of affirmative action pie, you know. When I was in France, I couldn't explain affirmative action to the French audience because they said either you're level and equal or not. But there's a permanent white underclass in America that's been building since World War II, and it was 20 million strong right after World War II. And that's what's got to be addressed. Nobody really thought about it. These people out here in the heartland and the South and the Midwest and New York State and all over, they're very much alike. They're never going to go to college. They're never going to get a decent education. So when we argue about who gets in the elite schools, what we're doing is playing an elite game of, okay, the people that are going to be the elite commissars of the empire must come from all classes.
Well, is that wrong? Is that so wrong? I mean, isn't that a good idea?
That is totally elitist. And stupid. You know, what we need is an enlightened electorate and enlightened citizenry that the Glenn Becks of the world cannot reach.
But isn't the American dream is that the opportunity for the whole kit and caboodle is there for everybody? You're saying forget it?
No, the whole kit and caboodle is not there for everybody. We've got at least 45 million Americans that are a low-wage permanent underclass in the third generation, the disposable labor that makes all the 401ks valuable and the corporations make a profit. And we beg the issue when we don't turn around and look, regardless of color, you know, at these people who it's not even an option. Like Barbara was saying, it was really expensive. Well, I'm one of those people. I grew up. I quit school in the 10th grade and went in the Navy and so on. I never heard the word college in my entire life.
Well, but, you know, I know firsthand that's a diverse community out there, even in that class. I mean, Ross, doubt that. What do you see here? Just a class problem?
Look, I mean, I think what Joe's saying is probably the strongest and most compelling critique of the argument that I made in my column, which is that, you know, it is, you could argue that it is sort of a red herring to worry about the composition of the elite, and that the danger here is that you end up, you know, my view is basically that elite colleges should worry more about socioeconomic diversity and so forth and should try and get more future farmers of America, more evangelical Christians, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But the danger is that, yeah, you just end up with some, you know, some red state tokens who, you know, go to the elite schools. But ultimately, the challenge that Joe's describing is the real challenge, that most Americans aren't going to go to Harvard or Yale or Williams or Bard or Swarthmore or wherever. Lots of them aren't going to go to college at all. And you need a country that, you know, has a kind of social and economic equality that goes beyond just, you know, the ability to send an extra five kids from your state to the Ivy League.
Sure, so you need to reach down to work on that economy. But if you give up on the goal, that's when people start opting out of the shared politics, isn't it, Ross?
I think it can be simultaneously the case that our elite is mistrusted and even hated in large swaths of the country, in part because it's perceived to be to not represent the country, to be an elite that's detached from the life of the country. That's true. But it might also be true that we do spend too much time worrying about the elite and setting Harvard and Yale as sort of, you know, the American dream isn't to go to Yale University. The American dream is to, you know, be a successful middle-class person who owns his own home, hopefully with reasonable mortgage payments and so on. I mean, I think that point is important too.
But we know, Barbara, if you don't have representation of people, and this is why affirmative action was seen as important in its prime time, if you don't have people represented in those top tiers of law and philanthropy and finance and academia and media and the arts, it's easy for people just to forget about the folks that they represent, forget about the places they came from.
No, and I think our political leaders routinely do that because the calculation is that poor working class people don't vote. So why bother with them? They're invisible. But I just want to throw in and see how Ross responds to this, that if we were going to have greater opportunity for people of all classes and white working class people in even the best colleges, et cetera, we'd have to spend some money on that. That would require a social investment. Tuitions are so high, they're so out of reach for people, we can't go on like this. And that is not, you know, something that Glenn Beck is going to support.
How about Ross Douthat? Ross, you're going to push some resources into that class that Joe Bajant's describing, that Barbara's describing?
Well, here's where, I mean, now let me try and split the difference between Barbara and Glenn Beck, if I can. I think that given this the state of America's finances and given the state of state finances around the country and so on, a lot of what you might call the liberal agenda for promoting economic opportunity of, you know, tripling, quadrupling and so on spending on higher education probably isn't going to happen and probably can't happen. And the you know, we're deep in an economic ditch and it's unlikely that tripling the state of Virginia's public education budget is going to get us out of that ditch. That being said, I think there's a lot of stuff you can do with the way we currently spend money now on public education in America that would reallocate, and basically, you know, it makes more sense for the American public to be investing in, for instance, community colleges than it does to be investing in high-end, state schools that, frankly, can stand on their own. I mean, public tax dollars should be subsidizing education that leads to economic advancement. And so, you know, it's the University of Virginia, right, which would be probably doing okay just on alumni contributions alone, may not be the place where the state of Virginia should be spending its higher education dollars.
Ross, hold that thought, if you would. And Joe and Barbara, we've got listeners banging down the door here. Maura in Des Moines, Iowa. Maura, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a very interesting subject. Well, as you know, I'm from Iowa, and just recently some people in the Tea Party put a billboard up in Mason City, and quickly took it down. And
this was the one with Obama and Lenin, and I forget who all on it.
Yes, yes. So I think it's really clear that there is an element of racism in the Tea Party. I've seen it myself. And they, I think, getting back to what Barbara was saying, the fact that most people, myself included, and probably my children, are not going to go to an Ivy League school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the most of the people that are worried about blacks getting too high up on the ladder are probably people that need to step out of their bubble and get into their communities and see what it's really like. I mean, if you're standing there listening to Glenn Beck and that's all you do, that's a very narrow image of what America is about. And as a white woman from Atlanta, Georgia, now living in Des Moines, Iowa, I have to say that racism is very alive and well, and it's up to people individually and groups to not allow it, to say it's not okay. And when it comes to higher education, I think what that gentleman just said is so true. I mean, our public schools are being, their budgets are being slashed, you know, and yet the, you know, Board of Regents still can find money for these colleges. Iowa State and University of Iowa are great colleges. Fortunately, we have great community colleges to feed into those. And so if we look at kids all across the board and making sure they have a proper public education, I think that's going to just set us up much better later in the future.
Make sure the resources are where they're most needed. Maura, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here from Hartford, Connecticut. Eric, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you see?
I listen to the conversation, and my thought turns towards the middle of the country and the state of the economy and the farming areas. And my thought was that Kansas, for example, which was a very liberal bastion for a long time, has changed its political leanings and voted in very conservative politicians who have ultimately undermined their economic future.
Eric, our time is short before the break. Joe Bajan, how about that point? Do you see the working class that Ross is writing about, white working class, if you like, voting its interests or not?
Well, of course not. You know, that's why there's so much discussion of it. You know, why do they go into the voting booth and shoot one foot off, and then the next election they shoot the other one off? And for a long time, the, you know, Thomas Frank, you know,
what's the matter with Kansas? Yep.
And discussing the heartland. The heartland is all that stuff between the major urban areas, the stuff that you don't see in the media, and so on. But poverty is defined officially for governmental purposes, is defined in urban areas. The image of what is poor is defined in urban areas. But the fact of the matter is that we have allowed more than an economic poverty. We've allowed an intellectual poverty to develop. Ignorance is a very dark prison. And so we're really shocked when we get these people with actually the Tea Party is just like he said, it's more affluent. But we're really shocked when we bear the fruit of our neglect of all the people, not just the people that go to college. I mean, look at it. It's at best a quarter. I mean, the government counts higher education as truck driving school and all this stuff.
Joe, we got it loud and clear, and we appreciate your time today. Joe Bajan, author of Deer Hunting with Jesus. Ross Douthat, Barbara Ehrenreich, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. talking this hour about whites, race, and advantage in the age of diversity. Race suddenly in the headlines, in the news, in the chatter again, in a louder way than we've heard in quite a while. And with a new twist, Ross Douthat is with us, columnist for the New York Times. His column this week getting a lot of attention was headlined, "The Roots of White Anxiety." Barbara Ehrenreich is with us from Alexandria, Virginia, author of Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America, journalist and essayist, writes a lot about class and poverty. Let's get a call from Diane in Omaha, Nebraska. Diane, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Well, I think it's high time we talk about race in this country, and I am a lower middle class white person who is only marginally employed. Mm-hmm. I believe that Mr. Douthat is and I did read his column. I think that he is falling victim to the same kind of media manipulation that that a lot of other news organizations, quote news unquote organizations, are falling prey to. He talks about breeding paranoia and about I really respect Mr. Douthat. Don't get me wrong. I think that he's one of the most reasoned of the conservative columnists. But it's true that it's more a class based thing, I think, and free trade I think is something that very few people are willing to look at and look at in a very deep way.
Look at trade, not race, you say. Doss, are you a victim of media manipulation, sir?
It's entirely possible, but I appreciate the caller's kind words. I think part of the point I was trying to make was that race and class are intertwined, and in a way I agree that class is arguably the more important factor. Going back to something an earlier caller said, she was talking about how the Tea Partiers or someone like them put up a billboard in Iowa that compared Obama, I think, to Lenin and Stalin, or maybe Lenin, Stalin, and Hitler. And she said, well, there you have proof that, you know, that the right wing is racist. And I think that that misses the point a little bit. I think that that billboard is proof more of the kind of class-based, the way that a kind of class-based paranoia intersects with a race-based paranoia.
What do you mean by that, Ross? What do you mean?
Well, it's not actually racist to compare Barack Obama to Lenin, right?
You're saying it's the socialist charge.
I'm saying that there is the anxiety. The current Democratic Party, the current liberal, and it's a liberal majority in America right now, is based around the coalition that George McGovern put together in the early 1970s. And it was a coalition of upper-middle-class whites and minority groups and younger voters and so forth. And it's that coalition, I think, that now inspires a kind of white working class and also just sort of generic right-wing paranoia. It's not the sense that black people are inferior or that, you know, the sort of old myths about, you know, black people being violent and dangerous and sexual predators and so on. It's a fear that the white upper class is working hand in glove with sort of favored minority groups, and it's a sense of racial grievance, but it isn't racism, if that makes sense. Maybe it doesn't.
Well, that can be a fine line, obviously.
Well, it's like Jesse Jackson, right? Jesse Jackson in the 1980s and 90s often sounded a note of racial grievance. It was the sense that blacks and Hispanics and other minorities were you know, being held hostage by evil white manipulators and so on. That isn't racism. It's a sense, it's grievance. It's a sense that your racial group is getting the shaft. And I think that's what you see more than traditional. And obviously these blur into each other. But I think that when people just say, oh, there's sort of right-wing populist racism, it misses the more complex reality and the way it interacts with class.
One more call right here. Jack in Middletown, Connecticut. Jack, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call.
Yeah.
Your speaker alludes to the fact that only two groups are represented in the elite schools, rich white kids and poor minority kids.
It's an oversimplification, but that's the gist.
Probably. But let's talk about upper middle class black families. I'm a black professional, and I am struggling to get my kids to these elite schools. As your speaker said, it would be easier for a white person in my income group to be able to send their kids to elite schools. My question is, what are the forces in play here? Why is it easier for my white counterpart to get their kids accepted to these schools kids with similar backgrounds, similar participation in schools, and what is it that it's hard for me to get my kids to these schools?
Jack, let us pick it up. Jack Ross, is that included in the statistics? We don't have our Princeton researcher with us anymore, but are they also...
The statistics overall, and obviously every case is different, but the statistics overall suggest that actually it is... It's not that these schools only contain rich white kids and poor minorities. They also include rich
minorities
and middle-class minorities
.
And so on. And I know that, you know, Harvard went through its – they did a study on the composition of black students at Harvard. And well, one thing you do see actually, and this may be relevant to the caller's point, is you see a lot of – Harvard went through its African-American community and found that a surprisingly low percentage was descended from American slaves as opposed to being descended from immigrants from Africa and the West Indies from the last 50 years and so on. So there may be a sense in which these policies disadvantage American blacks who are the descendants of the victims of slavery and segregation and so on.
It sounds like that might not be Jack.
It might not be Jack. I mean, I think that overall you're not looking at a situation where upper middle class minorities are disadvantaged, except in the sense that, you know, as I think Barbara was saying earlier, you are dealing with a community that, you know, middle class blacks have, you know, because they're newer to financial success than many white families, they have less wealth. They have similar incomes but less wealth, and that can affect how their ability to pay for college and so on. So some of that may be going on as well.
Ross Douthat, Barbara Ehrenreich, please stand by. I want to get more African-American perspective into this conversation. Nell Irvin Painter joins us right now from the Adirondacks, a professor emerita of American history at Princeton, author of The History of White People, and has helped us out many times with her perspective. Nell Irvin Painter, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Hello, Tom. Thank you so much.
So I hope you've seen Ross's column. I mean, there's a bigger kind of hullabaloo going on right now. But what do you make of this? You know, the 4-H kids and FFA kids, rural, poor, white kids left out while elite whites and minorities, you know, romp into the halls of power. What do you think?
Well, I think that Ross had a kernel of a good idea. But I think he left out so much that the column as a whole comes off as wrong-headed. For one thing, there's the wordless elision between poor whites and right Christians. What about poor Jews and Muslims? What about Muslims and Jews in these highly selected universities and colleges? What about legacies, that is, alumni children? What about the children of large donors? What about the FHA and Veterans Administration mortgage lending policies of the 1950s and 1960s that helped create the black-white differences in wealth, which Barbara mentioned?
So it's complicated. There's many facets to it. But let me ask you, if I may, Nell Irvin Painter, Ross has written some follow-up blog, and he says, I support, with some ambivalence, a kind of soft affirmative action on elite campuses for the sort of Americans, Southern and Midwestern, blue-collar and rural, who are much more likely than the current population of the Ivy League to be conservative white Christians. Would you favor that? No.
And who does he not want to admit? Does he want to cut back on Jews and Muslims? Does he want to cut back on legacies, donors' children? What about the
interesting question?
As we understand it,
so more diverse population at the table, Ross, and aware and ambitious. So where do you cut back if you're going to put some affirmative action in that direction?
Well, as long as we're designing policy in an ideal world, I think that the losers in the quest. This quest for greater socioeconomic diversity would include certainly legacy admissions and so on, but that's obviously there are reasons why colleges don't want to cut back on that. But your ideal losers would be the upper middle class, both white and minorities, I think. So you would basically you would have fewer upper middle class white kids. But you'd probably end up having slightly fewer upper middle class black and Hispanic kids as well. And you'd probably end up having slightly fewer Jewish kids. I mean, one of the reasons I made the point about Christians in the column is that it's clear that, you know, again, as a percentage of the American population, as opposed to, you know, as a percentage of the American population with high SAT scores, white Jews are vastly overrepresented at elite campuses. They're between 15% and 25% of the student body at a lot of Ivy League schools. So there, you know, you would end up probably with a few more, you know, if you had a few more FFA kids from Idaho, you'd probably have a few more white upper middle class kids like me. I mean, look, I you know, as a white upper middle class kid from Connecticut who went to an Ivy League school, I would presumably be disadvantaged by this shift.
It's just interesting.
Well, I think adding in Jews and other non-Christians shows how narrow this column really is. As far as I could see from the comments that flowed from the column, nobody picked up on the religious side of, and that is not at all to get into the question of Asian students who were very likely to be Christian but not white.
Well, I mean, some people picked up on it. We've got a comment at our website from Gemley saying, doesn't it cut both ways? Shouldn't Oral Roberts University then actively recruit bright young atheists? let's go to Martha in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Martha, you're on the air. What do you think, Martha?
Hi. Well, I just wanted to bring an possibly unrealistic proposal to any university.
Okay.
I wonder what would happen if when a student submitted their application, that instead of a name, they were given a number, and there would be two separate pages. And one page would be academic achievement and their goals for admittance,
mm-hmm.
and possibly what activities they were involved in. And the second page would have their race, gender, religion, and economic background.
Okay.
And then match that up and see what kind of conversations that would bring to the table.
Are you saying tear off the second page then? Don't consider race, gender, religion?
Yes, consider it. Match it up later. When you have chosen that student for admittance, mm-hmm. on their academic achievement and their goals and them as a person and their characteristics,
yep.
then take that number and match it up with their page that has their race, gender, religion, and economic background to it.
But don't go there first. Yeah, but Martha, it's an interesting experiment. Barbara, is it time to sort of maybe even tear off that second page, or is that, as Martha says, unrealistic?
Well, I just want to stand back a little bit from the elite admissions issue, where I guess, you know, yeah, I'd probably want to tear off that second page. But to say that, you know, the overwhelming number of students who go to college are not in elite schools, and the problem that is most upsetting to me is how many of them have to work full-time while going through either community college or, you know, some other, you know, maybe second or third tier college, and they're going to fail. And that this calls for, you know, they need help. We can't talk about this without saying, what are we going to do so a poor, white, let's make it Christian, whatever, young person
mm-hmm.
can go to school without breaking their back and their health and actually have time to study and get out? Because right now, only one quarter of people from lower income families finish college compared to 50% in general.
You know, it's personal for me. I mean, I went to pretty good school, but came from incredibly modest background, kind of dirt farm, came east on a hog truck from a stockyards, worked all the way through. White, black, brown, you want to be in the kind of country where kids from that kind of background can do it. Dave in Charleston, yeah. South Carolina. Dave, you're on the air.
Very quick point. I live down here from the north. I believe there's a two-tier system down in South Carolina, majority made up of the African-Americans and other minorities. I think that the poor whites here feel that they're part of the power structure, and I just don't believe that they deserve any sort of special treatment. Number one, the educational system down here is so poor for those who don't have money and influence that, number one, they'd never be prepared for an elite school, and they look at themselves as being part of that power minority that controls the South. And yep. I just don't feel there's any reason that they deserve any sort of extra benefit.
Dave, we got it. One more, Ray in Maquoketa, Iowa. Ray, you're on.
Yeah, my name is Ray Chase. I'm a member of the Carpenters Union. And I've noticed in the last, you know, since the Reagan administration that as the unions go, so seems to go to the country. Back then, very few blacks got into our unions, and now they're treated preferentially to get in, and they still, you know, very few of them apply. It's still, you know, like a 90% white situation, craft unions.
What do you take from that, Ray, for the big picture here?
The big picture basically is we don't stick together. And until we stick together, until, you know, it becomes more like a union-oriented country again. I mean, we carried the country on our backs for years. And now that the unions have gone downhill, so has the country. Until we all stick together, whites, blacks, Hispanics, and everybody, start joining and organizing again, the rich are just going to keep getting richer. The rest of us are just going to keep getting poorer. And it is a class issue. It's not a color issue anymore. It's a class issue.
Ray, we've got our time is short. Nell, do you see us going into a new era of racial tension or something else?
Tom, let me just say amen to what Ray had to say, because that is the absolute fundamental issue of how well working class and poor people are doing. And the situation we're in is tied directly to the weakness of the unions, which is not by accident. It has been policies since the 1970s.
Well, there we are. Yeah. I don't think we're finished with this racial conversation in this country, and it's certainly politically loaded right now. Ross Douthat, you've given us a particular beam to shine on it, and it's interesting to hear people's thoughts in response. We're going to keep on top of this one. I appreciate your time today, Ross, your column, and your work. Ross Douthat with The New York Times, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Nickel and Dimed and This Land Is Their Land. It's always good to have you with us, Barbara. Thank you for your time and thoughts today.
Oh, you're welcome.
And Nell Irvin Painter, author of The History of White People. Nell, thank you so much for your time today. Thanks for being here.
You're very welcome.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. You can continue the conversation at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.